The following message is from Temple Bible Church. For more information about the church and its ministries, visit www.templebiblechurch.org.
What a great day to honor our senior class of 2024. I want to also remind you that we still have some impact needs as well for impact season coming up. We still need one more morning host home. And we also need about 40 to 50 plus drivers, not the age of the drivers, but the number of people we need to be drivers for impact. So if you are interested in any of those things, also we need people to help prepare food during the week of impact, June 10th through the 13th, and also to serve at our carnival here at TBC on June 14th. All those things can be signed up for in the lobby at the impact table or online. Go to the hub on our church website and click on the link for impact, and you can sign up that way as well. So we are continuing our series in the book of Exodus, and this is part, I think, 17 for this series. And today's going to be about introducing the Ten Commandments, and we're going to cover the first two commandments as well. Now, many years ago, a comedian and political commentator, Stephen Colbert, had a congressman on his show, and this man had recently co-sponsored a bill to place a copy of the Ten Commandments in the House and the Senate and in courthouses all over the nation. And a few questions into the interview, Stephen Colbert put the congressman on the spot by asking, "So what are the Ten Commandments?" And the congressman said, "What are all of them? You want me to name them all?" And Colbert said, "Yes, of course." And the congressman began fumbling around and said, okay, don't murder, don't lie, don't steal. I can't name them all, he said. Now, if you're going to be lobbying for these to be on the wall of public buildings, then you might want to know what they actually are, right? Now, we might laugh at that and roll our eyes about that, but can we name all Ten Commandments? Maybe you can test yourselves later on today when you get home. But how many of you all had a copy of these on the wall of your house where you grew up? Raise your hand. Anybody? I think I saw a couple of hands out there. So we had a copy of the Ten Commandments on the wall of my house where I grew up. And my parents were very, and they placed it intentionally, I think, in the hallway. So we would pass by it like thousands of times as kids. And I think they even highlighted the one and starred the one that said, you know, honor your parents in, on the wall there. And but I think we've come to see the Ten Commandments as like a pawn in the culture wars, like a litmus test for how secular our nation has become. Or we view them like an old piece of sentimental furniture rather than something we should know intimately for ourselves. But they should be much more than that, I believe. So Matthew chapter 22, Jesus is asked by someone, what is the greatest command in the law? And he says, the greatest command is to love God with all your heart, soul, and mind. The second commandment is like it, and it's to love your neighbor as yourself. The entire law is based on these two laws of love. Now, we normally don't see law and love as connected like that. We see them as often contrary. But love has to remain central to our discussion of what the law is supposed to be about. We love God by worshiping him and using his name properly. We love parents by honoring them. We love our spouse by being faithful. We love our neighbors by protecting their lives and respecting their property and not lying to them. If we're going to remember the 10, you really can think in these two categories. There is vertical and horizontal. The first four commands are about loving God. That's vertical. And so what are the first four commands? Well, it's no other gods before me. It's no graven images. Don't take God's name in vain. And remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. Those are all about loving God. The last six are about loving our neighbors. This is horizontal. And so it's honor your parents, and then it's don't murder. I'm not sure why those are back to back on that, honoring your parents and not murdering. That took a dark turn, sorry. But don't commit adultery, don't steal, don't lie, don't covet. So hopefully you can see how loving God is connected to loving our neighbor, and we can't separate those two ideas. If we're struggling in our horizontal relationships, might it be that we're struggling in our vertical relationship with God? And so we're going to look at Exodus chapter 20. Look at verse 1. And God spoke all these words, saying, I am the Lord your God, who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery. You shall have no other gods before me. You shall not make for yourself a carved image or any likeness of anything that is in heaven above, or that is in the earth beneath, or that is in the water under the earth. You shall not bow down to them or serve them. For I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God, visiting the iniquity of the fathers on the children to the third and the fourth generations of those who hate me, but showing steadfast love to thousands of those who love me and keep my commandments. Now, I want to answer a couple of questions this morning. The first question is, why should we study the Ten Commandments? I'm getting these from a book by Kevin DeYoung that talks about the Ten Commandments. And the first reason is because of general ignorance. Many people don't know what the Ten Commandments are, and sometimes that includes people in Congress who want to put them on display. A recent survey found that only 14% of Americans can name all Ten Commandments. By comparison, 25% can name the seven ingredients in a Big Mac. Now, you might say, well, that's not fair, because they have a nice jingle for the Big Mac, right? But maybe we can get a little bit better at, you know, understanding what's in the Bible and the Ten Commandments. The second reason we should study these is the centrality to Mosaic ethics, meaning the ethics that are described in the Old Testament. You know, some people may downplay the importance of the Ten Commandments, but they did come directly from God amidst fire, this cloud of thick darkness, and a loud voice, so they seem pretty important to God, I believe. Now, they were also one of the three items that was placed in the Ark of the Covenant. You have manna, you have Aaron's staff, but you also have a copy of the Ten Commandments. And they function like the Constitution for Israel, and all the laws that follow are like the case law or application of these first ten. The next reason we should study these is centrality to New Testament ethics. In Romans chapter 13, when Paul gives a summary of what it means to be a Christian, living in obedience to God, it's amazing when you read this passage in Romans 13, how connected they are to the Ten Commandments. And he's talking about how a Christian should live an obedient life to God. Romans 13 says, "Owe no one anything except to love each other, for the one who loves another has fulfilled the law." So recognize how foundational love is to what Paul's saying here. For the commandments, you shall not commit adultery, you shall not murder, you shall not steal, you shall not covet, and any other commandment are summed up in this word: you shall love your neighbor as yourself. Love does no wrong to a neighbor. Therefore, love is the fulfilling of the law. So Paul is saying that these Ten Commandments are the way for God's people to love one another. So whenever we obey the Ten Commandments or these commandments, we are fulfilling this law of love. There are 613 laws in the Old Testament, and those can be summarized by the Ten Commandments, which can be summarized by the two: love God and love your neighbor. So you can think of it like this kind of file system. The first two files would be love God, love neighbor. The next thing down would be the Ten Commandments. And then from that flows the rest of the 613 laws in the Old Testament that all flow out of those two first laws, which are the laws of love, loving God and loving one's neighbor. The next reason that we should study these is really important. It's because the law is good. I think we have this allergy to thinking of the law being something that's good and positive. We normally see it as negative, but the law is actually good. In Psalm chapter 1, the writer says, "Blessed is the man whose delight is in the law of the Lord, and on his law he meditates day and night." The writer of Psalm 1 sees the law as something he wants to meditate upon day and night, ruminate on it, chew on it, and he finds delight in the law of God. There's also a practical element here. Think about how much better the world would be if everyone just obeyed the Ten Commandments. You wouldn't need copyright laws, locks on doors, fraud protection, wouldn't need weapons or alarm systems, wouldn't need courts, contracts, or prisons. It teaches us how to live and restrain sin in society. Think of how many things you did this week, that you had to do this week, that may be connected back to the idea that people might not follow the Ten Commandments, so I better do this, whatever it might be. It's amazing how practical they are. What if everyone followed the Ten Commandments in our world? There's another way in which the law is good, and it's this: it reveals our need for a Savior. So after last week's hailstorm, how many of you all found some hail damage on your vehicle? Raise your hand. Well, I'm not seeing too many hands out there, so you guys are in good shape. But I had just bought a car for my son and I to share for a while. And before I made my first payment, we had this storm. Now, it's a 2013, but still. Now, if you know the car I drove before, a 2013 is like brand new to me, okay? But I was down at the Outback, and my car was totally exposed, so I was worried. I was inside when this hit, and it sounded like the roof was about to crash down on us at the Outback. And I'm really worried about my car out in the parking lot, and so after the hail, I go out to have a look, and I really couldn't see any damage at all when I first inspected my car there in the parking lot. Now, I was parked next to Caleb DeLord, who's one of our faithful leaders down there at the Outback with our students. And I'm parked next to him. I could see hail damage pretty much all over his car, but nothing really on mine. It looked as if God allowed the hail to fall on Caleb's car, but he somehow protected mine. And I had this thought, I guess I'm Israel and you're Egypt. But then after church, Josh Copeland, who plays bass up here sometimes, talked with him in the parking lot. He said, hey, how's your car? And I said, well, let's go check it out. So we go over to my car and it still has some beads of water all over it. And I said, I think I'm in the clear. I don't see any hail damage on the car. Do you? And he said, man, listen, he goes, everybody out here has some hail damage. Trust me. And I said, Josh, I really don't think you know what you're talking about. I think that my car is just fine. It's going to be okay. And he said, listen, tomorrow, go wash your car, dry it off with a towel, and then put your car in the proper light, and then see if you have any hail damage. And so I followed his advice, and I took it to the car wash and got it washed, towel dried it, and then I began counting all the divots that I could see all over my car. I count up to 30 divots at certain places all over my car. And then when my insurance adjuster came the next day, he found over 50 or 60, I think. And once my car was in the proper light, I could see all the flaws. This is how the law acts for us. If we don't know the law, we can think our lives look pretty good. We don't see any major issues. But the law helps us see our lives in the proper light. When we put our lives next to the law, we see all our flaws, we see all of our sin, and God's law has this way of shining a spotlight into our hearts that allows us to see the sin that we never knew about before. But even though the law is effective at revealing our sin, it is ineffective in helping us deal with it. You know, some compare the law to a mirror. This is not mine. I only got this for this demonstration, just so you know. But what's the purpose of a mirror? Well, it reveals what needs to be changed. We would never look in the mirror and see that our face needs washing and our hair needs styling, and then use the mirror to wash our face and to then style our hair. That would be an improper use of the mirror. The purpose of the mirror is to drive us to the water. And so it is with the law. It helps us not by cleaning us up. We don't use the law to clean ourselves up, but it drives us to the living water, which is Jesus Christ. We would never do away with or break the mirror because it pointed out our flaws. In the same way, we don't abolish the law because it points out our sin. We let it point us to Jesus Christ. So that's why we should still study the Ten Commandments. So why should we obey the Ten Commandments? Well, we want to obey them because of who God is. Exodus chapter 20, the first couple of verses there says, and God spoke all these words saying, I am the Lord your God. And this statement is foundational to what all that follows with the commandments after this. I am the Lord your God. The first words of Exodus chapter 20 are not just filler words before the commandments. They are foundational to what follows, and all that God commands flows from who he is. It's an expression of his heart and his character. They don't just show us what God wants, but they show us what God is like. They show us who he is and his character and his goodness. And it's not just because of who God is, but it's because of who he is to us. Notice the possessive pronoun here. It says, I am the Lord your God. You belong to me. We belong to him. And he gives us these commands for our good. Now, if you think that God's law is burdensome, maybe you're a skeptic, maybe you're not yet a Christ follower, maybe you are a Christian, and you've just always associated the idea of law with negative and seen it as burdensome. Do you know how many laws are on the books in the U.S.? It's a trick question because no one knows. In 2008, they hired a firm to see how many criminal offenses there were in federal law, and 5 years later, they determined they lacked the manpower to answer such a question. So God isn't trying to like crush us with red tape and regulation. So we should think of the Ten Commandments not as prison bars, but more like traffic laws. You know, I know this is none of you, but there are some people out there in the world that they think that the world would be better off with no traffic laws. There are people like that, right? But traffic laws aren't meant to be a burden for us. They are meant to help us live life better and travel safely. And they exist for our good so we can travel and be safe. This is how we should think of God's law. God's law is for our good, is for our provision. And so we obey because of who God is. We also obey because of what God has done. Exodus 20, verse 2, the second part of verse 2 says, who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery? This is what God did. We've been saying in the Exodus story how it parallels our story. And if you notice in the progression in Exodus, the story goes like this. They're set free from Egypt, and then the law comes after their deliverance. God didn't come to them when they were slaves saying, you know, here's the thing, guys. Follow these Ten Commandments for a few years, and if you're successful, I might set you free from Egypt. That's not how it happened. God sets them free. He delivers them, and then later in the wilderness, he gives them the law. Some people view Christianity like this, that God has all these rules, and if I obey the rules, then God will save me and God will love me. The Israelites were enslaved and could do nothing to change their condition, and then God shows up and delivers them, and then he gives them a new way to live. Kevin DeYoung writes, the Ten Commandments are not instructions on how to get out of Egypt. They are rules for free people to stay free. Salvation is not the reward for obedience. Salvation is the reason for obedience. So we don't obey to get saved, but we obey because we are saved. So Jesus doesn't say, you know, if you obey my commandments, I'll love you. That's not what he says. He says, if you love me, you'll keep my commandments. So our doing is only because of what he has already done, what he's already accomplished. The next reason that we should still obey the Ten Commandments are this, because the moral law has not changed. Now some will say, especially for the graduating seniors, you're going to hear this if you haven't heard it already where you go to school now, you're going to hear people say at some point in your life, you know, no one really follows the Old Testament law anymore. All these verses about morality are right next to the verses about what kinds of clothes to wear, what kind of food to eat, and nobody really follows that anymore, so we don't have to listen to the Old Testament stuff, right? They usually say this whenever they want to justify maybe a sexual relationship the Bible speaks against, but it's interesting. They don't use that logic when someone steals from them, lies to them, or tries to murder them. They want the law obeyed in those situations. So listen, I don't want to be demeaning, but this is just a lazy way of interpreting the Bible. You may hear even hear well-meaning Christians say, you know, now that Christ has come, we're no longer under the law. And they might quote passages like Romans chapter 6:14, which says, you are not under law, but under grace. But for this to make sense, we need to differentiate between different types of law. Because for Israel, there were three categories of law. There was civil, ceremonial, and moral. And civil law was for Israel as a nation, and it dealt with things like land use restrictions, regulations for debt, guidelines for waging war. The ceremonial law dealt with the tabernacle and later the temple, regulations for worship and sacrifices and festivals. But the moral law is what the Ten Commandments are about. And it is the righteous standard for relating with God and with other people. And we need to see all these different kinds of law, civil, ceremonial, and moral, through the lens of Jesus. Because ceremonial law is no longer in effect because they foreshadowed Christ. And so once he came and fulfilled them, they were no longer necessary. The civil law was for Israel at a certain time in their history. And now we might take some principles and apply those to our laws today, or even how we live and treat people. But we aren't under civil law in the way that Israel was back then. But when Paul says we are no longer under law, he's referring to civil and ceremonial law, but he also means we cannot be justified by simply keeping the law. Our salvation does not depend on our ability to keep the law, but the New Testament never declares an end to God's moral law. God's moral law does not change. It stays the same. And we know that because it is reaffirmed in many places in the New Testament by Jesus and also by the apostles in their writings. For each one of the Ten Commandments, you can find a corresponding statement somewhere in the New Testament that affirms or extends the commandment that we see in Exodus chapter 20 in the Ten Commandments. Philip Graham Ryken, he says this, "As believers in Jesus Christ, do we still need to keep God's law? Yes. The moral law expresses God's perfect and righteous will for our lives. So Jesus commands us to keep it, not as a way of getting right with God, but as a way of pleasing the God who has made us right with him." So let's look at the first command in verse 3. "You shall have no other gods before me." Now, we don't realize how significant this statement is, because the fact that the Jews were a monotheistic people believing in one God, this is great evidence that God truly revealed himself to them. And why is that? Well, no other nation worshiped just one God back then. They were all polytheistic, worshiping many gods. So why would any nation decide on their own to worship just one God when everyone around them worshiped many gods? There's no reason for it, no explanation for it, unless the real God showed up in history, revealing himself, telling them to worship the one true God. I think this is a great defense for the truthfulness of the Bible. It's also important to remember that this command wasn't given just because. It wasn't given in a vacuum. There's context to it, because they had just come out of Egypt, and Egypt was a nation that worshiped many gods, had many idols, and Israel adopted many of their idols. And so through the 10 plagues, God was dismantling the pantheon of Egyptian gods, the false gods of Egypt. And now here we are in the wilderness, and God gives them the first command. He says, "You shall have no other gods before me," because he wants their worship. Now, if you're skeptical of the Christian faith, you might see this first command and say, you know, how could God command exclusive worship of himself? Isn't that a bit like selfish, maybe intolerant? Well, the best analogy we can think of is the one of marriage, because that's how the Bible portrays God's relationship with his people. So imagine if you came home, if you're married, imagine if you came home one night and told your spouse that you had met someone else, that you'd like to spend some nights over at their place, but not to worry, because you still love her and want to be with her some nights as well. What should she say? She'd say, "No, it's me or it's her. You need to make up your mind." And she'd have every right to be jealous in that scenario. We wouldn't chastise her for being angry and upset if that happened. She's doing exactly what a loving wife should do. She's being jealous, and she should be jealous. For example, whenever you watch any kind of romantic movie and you see a couple and they have this beautiful, exclusive love for one another throughout their lives, I've never heard someone watch a film like that and say, "You know, it was a good movie, but I just didn't like how the couple had this exclusive love only for each other. That just kind of seems intolerant and legalistic. Like, no one says that. Why don't we say that? Because we're caught up in the romance. We're caught up in the love story. And the same should be true in how we view our relationship with God. We should be caught up in the love story because love is at the heart of this first command. You know, some relationships are meant to be either or, not both and. And marriage is meant to be exclusive, and the same is true in our relationship with God. So how do we identify our idols? What are some questions we can ask to identify idols we struggle with in our lives? Well, the first question is, what do we love? If love should be at the center of our walk with Jesus, then it should not be surprising that love is still at the center when our lives get hijacked by idolatry. So what do you love? Or to ask in a different way, what do you most desire in this life? When your mind is free to roam, when you have free time, nothing else to think about, what does your mind wander to? What does it roam to? What do you think about? How do you spend money? What are your passions? Like, what gets you charged up about life? It could be a sport, a recreation, a hobby, or personal interest. It could be career, ambition, health, fitness. It could be even something good like ministry in the church. And many of these things are good, of course, but we know that sometimes idolatry isn't so obvious because good things, we can turn those into something that's godlike in our lives. So the first question, what do we love? And then what do we trust? For us, idols are not just these statues to which you and I bow down to, but they are things our soul leans upon. What is your soul leaning on for security and stability? Is it some form of addiction? Is it your job, insurance policy, the government, the economy? Is it your family, social position? Is it science? Is it medicine? And you know, sometimes our idols aren't tangible really much at all. There's a chart that's Tim Keller, I think, uses in his book, Counterfeit Gods, and it's this idolatry chart, or it looks kind of like an idolatry bingo card, you know? And what he does is he unpacks these different idols we can struggle with, and one on the left-hand side, you see comfort, approval, control, and power as ones that he identifies we often struggle with and don't even know about it. On the top row, you see ways in which these things play out in our lives. When I see that list, I'm convicted by all, but primarily in my life, the idol of control. Because the way it plays out in my life and why it goes unrecognized and how it might look in my life is competence. I try to be competent at things so I don't look like a failure, look like a fool in front of people. And so sometimes what can look like competence just on the outside, underneath there's this idol of control, and I want to be in full control. And then the ways in which the price I might pay in my life to have this idea of idol of control is loneliness and spontaneity. My wife will tell you that Dave does not like spontaneity. My wife, however, she loves spontaneity. And so it's really funny to see how God brings people together that can help sharpen one another. And so I can struggle with that. So it's a way that it's a price it'll pay in my life. My worst nightmare can be uncertainty. The biggest problem emotion can be anxiety in my own life. And then others can sometimes feel condemned, judged, and offended by me because of my idol of control. And then what is a gospel reality that it counterfeits? Well, if I'm going to inform my life with the gospel, I've got to meditate on God's blessings and make sure that I'm not trying to grab hold of his blessings through my own competence, my own hard work and effort, but recognize that those are just simply gifts that he bestows on our lives because of his goodness and his grace in our lives. And so what are some things that you might struggle with? You can pull out your phone if you want and take a photo of that if you'd like and think about it later on. But where do you struggle when it comes to these intangible idols that we can have sometimes in our lives? You know, this first command, it forbids worshiping the wrong God, but the second command forbids worshiping the true God in the wrong way. So look at verse 4. You shall not make for yourself a carved image or any likeness of anything that is in heaven above, or that is in the earth beneath, or that is in the water under the earth. You shall not bow down to them or serve them, for I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God, visiting the iniquity of the fathers on the children to the third and the fourth generation of those who hate me, but showing steadfast love to thousands of those who love me and keep my commandments. I'll address the difficult part of this passage first. When God says he will visit the iniquity of the fathers on the children to the third and fourth generation, that's not referring to some generational curse, hex, or demonic spirit that's hanging over a family. God's not saying to a righteous child, you know, tough break, kid, your dad was wicked, so now you're going to get it. Like, that's not what that's about. So what does it mean exactly? Well, look at verse 5 carefully, because it says, he will visit the iniquity of the fathers to the third and the fourth generation, key phrase, of those who hate me. That last phrase tells us the children share in their father's punishment because they share in their father's sins. Conversely, the promise of steadfast love is for those who obey and want to follow him. So we'll unpack this more when we get to Exodus chapter 32 and the golden calf incident. But sometimes our idolatry is so subtle that we might not be worshiping the wrong God, but worshiping the real God in the wrong way. And so God gets to decide how he is worshiped and how we approach him. You know, at times we try to make God seem more tangible and real by bringing him down to our level, the level of his creation. And so why is it wrong to use a created object or an image in our worship of God? Well, if we try to depict God, what image would we use? There's nothing created that can fully capture or comprehend God. So what image would you use? Well, you can't really think of anything that would really depict who God is. So God made us in his image, but sometimes we want to return the favor, and we want to remake God in our image. It's what happens when people say things like, I just can't believe in a God who would fill in the blank. Or, you know, when I think about God, I like to think of him this way, fill in the blank. And so often we put our own presuppositions and our own personalities and impose those things on God. But so often that version of God resembles how we like to see ourselves, and we're really remaking God in our image. You know, C.S. Lewis once said, we don't want a father in heaven, we want a grandfather in heaven. So how are grandparents different than parents? I mean, you know the answer to that question. I had the privilege of growing up close to a set of grandparents, and I could walk to their house whenever I wanted. And if I wanted candy or ice cream in the middle of the day, I knew where to go. And it was not to my parents. It was to my grandparents. Because grandparents generally give you what you want. And why is that? Because they don't have to deal with you the rest of the day. I mean, the parents, of course, do. The grandparents don't necessarily. So parents generally give you what you need. And that's what God is like. He's a father. He's not a grandfather. He has our best interests in mind, our provision in mind, and he's good. And he wants to see fit that he provides for us in the way that he sees fit. So often we see him, we want to see him as just giving us what we want when we want it. That's our expectation of God. We've got to see his law as flowing from his character and his goodness. And he acts like a father who loves and cares for us in our lives. And finally, we don't have to make God more tangible by creating images of God, because he's already created them. He's made us in his image. So we are how he chose to show off what he is like. So whenever we commit idolatry, we not only diminish God, but we diminish all of mankind and this image of God that he's created. We've got to see this connection between these first two commands and all the rest as they'll follow. Listen to these words. Mistreating other people and worshiping idols have the same roots, a violation of divine things. In one case, we are looking for God's image where it doesn't exist, idolatry. And in the other case, we are ignoring God's image where it does exist, sins against our neighbors. We are God's statues in the world, marking out the planet as his and his alone. He does not need our help in making more images, but he asks for our witness. Father, we're thankful that you're good to us. We're thankful that you're more like a father who wants the best for those he's created. And God, we know that for so many of us, that idea of fatherhood and discipline that we've sensed from you, we don't always see it as love. And God, I pray that if anyone is here this morning that is just struggling to see your law as good, your law as pointing us to the Savior, your law as revealing what is broken in us and pointing us to the only one that can fix it and redeem it, and that is yourself. God, would you help us to see this law work itself out properly in our lives and point us to the gospel, not causing us to think we can earn favor with you and earn salvation from you, but to see you as the one that provides us salvation. God, I pray if anyone is here this morning that doesn't yet know you, isn't following you, and they've had all kinds of hang-ups and baggage about the Christian faith, and they see it all as just law, law, law. God, if today they would see it as love, love, love. God, make that so real to them that today, that they would fall on their face and worship you and surrender and desire to have you truly become their Father today, Father. We pray this in your name. Amen.